But before the question, I should mention that the first note for the first lecture has been corrected, let's say, corrected on this particular condition. So all the other representation can be related to all representation via a similar transformation. And if they are related by the unitary similar transformation, then you can show that this is always true. So there's a bunch of gamma matrices that is related to wild basis with unitary similar transformation. Then this condition is always true. But turns out, if you just randomly write down a matrix, who knows what? And then this is the definition of a similar transformation, and most of the, it's very hard to say because it's infinity, but I would still say most of the matrix are not unitary. And if you choose this to be not unitary, then you can show that this thing actually doesn't satisfy the Hermitian condition, which tells us that the Hamiltonian, the physics, actually impose a condition on what kind of gamma matrix we can use. So it's just a side says this is a real, that's a different thing. Okay, it's a strong constraint. So it probably was pretty hard for a while to figure out the answer that they both satisfy Dirac algebra and this constraint. So that's just a correction to, or an upgrade of what I said in lecture. Okay, as I said, since you guys don't have questions, and I'm puzzled, so I have a question. But let's review what we learned on Tuesday. On Tuesday, basically, we did quite a lot of things, but one of our focus is the wild spinner. Especially in the tutorial, we said a lot of things about this wild spinner. What we said is, first of all, in the lecture, we defined this thing. It says, can define the left or right-handed well spinner to be a projection of a Dirac spinner. Well, the projection operator is defined by the gamma phi matrix, which has many, many good properties. So that's basically what we learned in lecture, is that we can do that, and it's Lorentz invariant. So it's a good way to break down the Dirac spinner into smaller things. And then in tutorial, we see something very interesting about the wild spinner. We concluded that a good wild spinner, let me define good. A good one is the one that have definite handing. So that it doesn't like change because somebody is moving faster, or it doesn't change because you're looking at it a couple seconds later. It has a definite handedness that is conserved over time and is Lorentz invariant. Okay, so that's the definition of a good wild spinner. Then you realize this thing means that this thing is massless. And you find that this mass term is just really troublesome. It either make things not Lorentz invariant, I'll make it not conserved over time. So that's what we say in the tutorial. And what we also see in the tutorial in the last part and I hope everybody has a go over it, which is if you take a right-handed well spinner and then you do this C conjugation on it, and then you investigate and realize this become a left-handed. And I think we just did by examining what's the eigenvalue of gamma 5 on this thing. You realize, huh, C conjugation can flip the handedness of the right, the well spinner. If you have a right-handed well spinner, and then if you say conjugated, it becomes left-handed. And since we know the Dirac spinner is built up by one left-handed spinner, well spinner, and a right-handed well spinner, we concluded this is how we can build a Dirac spinner. It says that we have some sort of right-handed spinner. If we have another right-handed spinner, it doesn't matter. Let's just say conjugated. So we conclude I can make a Dirac spinner out of two Weyl spinner. Yeah, so this is just what we have seen on Tuesday about the importance of the Weyl spinner. How do you use them to be, as a building block to make a Dirac spinner? And now comes my question. When we write down the Dirac equation, or let's write down the Dirac Lagrange. Maybe I haven't told you yet, but I should have, is that during the interview, you are not really required to memorize any formula as long as with guidance you are able to derive it. So don't focus on memorization. I'll never ask you, say, what's the U solution look like. That's not going to be a question. But aside from that, I do hope you remember Dirac Lagrange. Just that. Like, you should walk into the interview room knowing that. But beyond that, we can all derive from scratch. Okay, so, but if we look at this, hey, there is a mass term. This clearly says that Dirac spinner has a mass. And I just said, you can make the Dirac spinner out of a two Weyl spinner, and the two Weyl spinner, since they have a definitive handedness, they are massless. How did the Dirac spinner get a mass out of two massless things? It seems the mass just come out of nowhere. You have one massless thing, another massless thing, you put them together. Hey, now we have mass. So, how do you think, why? It's very puzzling, isn't it? So I think I'll give you a couple minutes to ponder on that. Now talk to each other as much as you want. You talk to each other, wonder, let's ponder this question. How do I make a massive thing out of two massive?
For example, in the standard model, how they get mass, or?
Well, our answer will eventually lead us to how in standard model. That's exactly how the standard model particle get mass. But our question is way simpler. Okay. No, I like it. Like, yeah, if I ask to discuss, please feel free to discuss. This is very awesome. I hear people talking. That's excellent. Okay, so let's just inspect. We have a mass term, right? And you wonder, basically the question is, you have a massive Dirac spinner, clearly, it has a mass term. But you wonder, does the Weyl spinner really have no such term, such that look like a mass, a Dirac conjugate, and a spinner? Maybe it actually secretly do, but that can't be the correct answer because on Tuesday we spent so much time to inspect if it secretly has a mass term that it screws up everything. Just like, woo, you can't talk about a right-handed spinner anymore. It doesn't even make sense. Okay, so let's do this inspection together. What I'm gonna do, seemingly very silly, what I'm gonna do is write down this mass term and insert identity. I insert two identity, which, because I have a really nice projection operator, this is my identity. That's why we choose them to be projection operator to this first place, is this sum to one. Okay, this seems to be a really silly step, but now we break down the mass term seemingly to be how many terms? Naively. If I just look at this expression, how many mass terms do we have? It's four, right? Naively, I would say there's four terms. That's what we do. If at a very young age, we know A plus B times C plus D, then we can expand. So let's inspect the first term. Okay, I will only inspect what happens in the middle. It's all sandwiched by Poisson diagonal Poisson. So the only interesting part is what is in the middle. So I want to look at this, and I want to know what it is. Well, we know this is a matrix. These are gamma matrix. Let's make use of it. So the first step is clear. The next step is also clear. I just multiply. And now, in order to, they have two projection operators. I don't know what to do with them. But if somehow I can swap them, then I would know how to do it, what to do with them. So let's swap them. There is nothing to swap in the first term, but there is gamma 5. I have a good friend, gamma 5. And the next step is realize whatever happened, because swapping gamma 5, you always pick up a minus sign. This turns into a p minus. Yeah? And I know this. They are very nice orthogonal projection operators. It turns out, for these four terms, if the projection operator is the same, then it just doesn't give any contribution, because after swapping with gamma zero, the projection operator switched type, and different type of projection operators are orthogonal. So naively, we have four terms, but actually, the only surviving term includes this guy and this guy. And now I'm going to rewrite them into what we know they are. So this thing is a Poisson plus Geiger. Remember, these are Hermitian. Hermitian, so it doesn't matter if this projection operator is acting from the to the left on the conjugate or acting to the right on the Poisson. So that's how I will rewrite it. So that's just the definition. Projection operator gives me my Weyl spinner. Projection operator gives me my Weyl spinner. And then the last step is just using the Dirac conjugate. So realize that, yes, there is no mass term for the Weyl spinner, because these are not the same Weyl spinner. This is a type 1 Weyl spinner. This is a type 2 Weyl spinner. In principle, they don't have to do anything with each other. They're completely independent of two Weyl spinners. And then the other term is the same. So what we learned, the moral of the story, is that we can make a massive Dirac spinner out of the two messes, well, spinner provided the interrupt. So this is actually the interaction term because it involves two types of this, both types of the well spinner. And it provided a mess for Dirac spinner. And I do want to explain how this is connected in the standard model about how particle gain mass, but I think I'll do a better job in a little while. So at this point, I'll mention that in standard model, this mass is actually some coefficient we need to measure times the width of a scalar field. So this is shared by all particles. And this coefficient is basically depends on which particle you are. You are lighter, then you have a smaller coefficient. If you are heavier, you have a heavier coefficient. And this part, I can't really say anything. You might have a glimpse at it at a QFD2, but this would be the central part of the standard. Like within the first few lectures, this is all we're focusing why there will be a scalar field that has a depth, the expectation value. So that's just after this scalar field condensed, then effectively this gives you a mass. Okay, we'll come back to say a little bit more about this master, since it's interest. Yeah? So we're happy with our little puzzle and the resolution of it. And I'll leave you as an interesting exercise to check that the kinetic term, if you think about it, the only difference between kinetic term and mass term is it has an extra gamma mu. In the matrix sense, it also has derivative, but the most important thing is the kinetic term compared to mass term has a gamma mu hidden in the slash. And then if you think about our derivation, so before you have to swap gamma 5 with a gamma 0. But now you have to swap with somebody else, which is the gamma mu. You swap once, you get a minus sign. You swap twice, you get a plus sign. So you would realize that to check, because this extra gamma mu thing, your kinetic term will look exactly like what it should be. It's like each of them has an individual kinetic term, they don't talk to each other. So of course, this is one type of well spinner. It has its own connector. It has the other type, has its own. That's why we say that the well spinner doesn't have mass, because it doesn't have a term that where both of them are plus. So let's just, you can either wave your hands, says yes, swapping another type. Well, it's like never swept. Or you can actually go through two lines of derivation to show that this is true. Okay. Now we're going to open a new topic. Actually, I'm surprised. So far, none of you guys complained and said, why are we studying all this well spinner? It seems it's just like some mathematician's little game to play. I have a Dirac spinner, let's project it around and see what happens. But why? So today, the goal of the majority of the rest of the day, I want to propose a problem. And we'll try to solve it. And then along the line, you will find that the well spinners are pretty useful. I want to make a disclaimer that whatever I'm going to say from now on is historical facts, but not happened in the chronological order. That's just help to make my point. So I'm going to propose this problem first. Problem. The problem is, suppose there is a universe, which is like our universe, which is like actually the mirror copy of our universe. You just put a mirror and then project all our universe into the mirror. And then you say, let's somehow go into the mirror universe and ask the question, do all the physics laws are the same? So that's the question. Lots of people ponder on this. Well, the question is a mirror universe of our universe the same? Have the same physics laws? Well, a lot of people says of course, and they have good reasons. Yes, it does. It's because they experiment on like currents, anything related to electron or photons, this QED business. E&M, classical E&M. E&M does respect to this proposed mirror symmetry. And some other people who are colliding nuclei together, known as a strong force later, also supports, says we have tons of experimental evidence that this thing, mirror symmetry, is real. So that's what people's opinion. And then there came a Chinese-American physicist. His name is Wu Jianxiong, and the English translation somehow becomes C.S. Wu. It's just not the same as Chinese. I have no idea why. I can't remember what these two letters stand for because it doesn't sound like a Jianxiong to me. But anyway, she did an experiment. She proposed the following experiment. She says, I have a bunch of nuclei, specifically 16 cobalt. And then they will decay. They'll go through a beta decay. And since it's a beta decay, it emits electrons. So this experiment is real. It happened, and it's one of the most important experiments in the particle physics history. So there's this nuclei, and I think the full reaction is to turn into a nickel, and of course have some electrons, some neutrinos, and it turns out that this nickel is very unstable. It's very excited, so it decide it's not unstable. It's just it's unstable, but it's excited, and it pop out some photons. But what she does is that she says that she collect a bunch of this cobalt, and then she can't find some people who are very good at lowering temperature, literally lowering the temperature as close to absolute zero possible. Because what she wants is to align all the nuclear spin together. So suppose she achieved that. And this is, I'm just drawing this, it's because a spin up thing, it can be thought about, it has some angular momentum. Okay, so nuclear spin is like this. So she cools everything down. And then, this you probably heard about in quantum mechanics, if you apply some magnetic field, then your nuclear spin is going to either align or anti-align with the magnetic field. So she tried that. She cooled down his cobalt. They're very, very, very cold. And they have nuclear spin aligned in the same direction. And then she saw some electrons come out. So what she does is she constructed the mirror experiment. So how did she achieve that? What she used to provide this magnetic field is something we're very familiar. It's a solenoid. So it looks like a bunch of, it looks like a spring, but you put a current through it. And if you think about a solenoid in the mirror, it goes the other way. If you have a clockwise solenoid, and you look into the mirror, it becomes a counterclockwise solenoid. And that's what exactly she does. And what that achieves is that the nuclear spin would flip. In the mirror. And then, of course, these are called momentum. Electrons coming out is really just the momentum. And in the mirror universe, you would expect the momentum to just go like this. Expected electron. And she did the experiment. And she found that. So she says, assuming our mirror universe has exactly the same physics laws as our universe does, then I should have expect we should have expected the electron momentum shouldn't be changed by the mirror. On the other hand, the nuclear spin should have been swept just because the solenoid in the mirror, it'll become the other way. You'll have experiment on this yourself very soon. So she is very perplexed. And actually, this is such a shocking result. Our renowned Pauli, when he heard about this, he says, this is completely nonsense. It's like his original quote. And then there's some, you know, person trying to persuade Pauli, you know, this is real. This result, he was trying to explain the experiment, and Pauli just like interrupted him. No, this experiment has to be repeated. And of course, people repeat this experiment. It's real. Like, the mirror universe doesn't follow the same law as ours does. Yeah.
Why do we expect if like the spin flips and everything, why would you expect the electrons to go out the same way?
Well, so, because remember, this is a mirror. Let's see what happens in the mirror. A mirror, if something goes down, in the mirror, it still goes down. But if in the mirror, if something is doing rotation like this, in the mirror, it will be doing rotation like this. I know, like I explain on board is the worst way to try to get to understand what's going on. But I promise you within at best 5 minutes, you will all have experience about this particular, what should I expect in the mirror experiment. You will all do it yourself. Okay, so, but the story is, I promise, in about 5 minutes. Okay, the thing is, the mirror symmetry is not a symmetry of our universe. It's actually maximally broken, later people discover, by weak interaction. And this is the problem. Now I finally finished the state. The problem. The problem is now we have this experiment tells us the mirror theory is broken. And for the rest of the day, what we're going to do is to be a theorist and find an interaction term, actually do exactly that. we our job is to find an interaction term that breaks mirror symmetry. So, well, see, when you say what kind of interaction term can I write down? One way of doing this is if I just write down all of the interaction terms, one of them must be right. Right? So what we're gonna do is actually called a classification. But let me just briefly introduce what are we going to classify? What are we use going to classify? As you probably realize, mirror symmetry is one of these discrete symmetry. It's not connected to Lorentz, the rotation or whatever that we know. It's a symmetry that cannot use our favorite method. This doesn't work anymore. But let me just do a very silly thing, but that will get my point, is I want to say the mirror symmetry, which basically said, if you think about a mirror symmetry, it's like in the mirror, on the plane of mirror, nothing changed. But if you're perpendicular to the mirror, you get a flip. That's a mirror, right? Yeah? That's what the mirror does, is that if you see, I'm standing in front of a mirror, I will still see myself. But if I'm walking towards mirror, then the other person will walk towards me, will be in different directions. So I'm proposing, instead of studying mirror symmetry, we study the symmetry which is also broken, of course, which is called parity. And the parity is just a name given by flipping all x, y, z axes. So this symmetry is called a parity. If you're flipping all your three axes, that's just by definition parity. And what I want to do is to show you that it's related to mirrors. So this is x, y, and then my person is z. You have to look at me to see this. So x, y, my head is z, yeah? So this is the positive direction, and up is positive. And now I'm just gonna rotate. Yeah, did you see? The x and the y positive direction is flipped into a different direction, the z remain the same. So I conclude parity is related to mirror symmetry by a rotation, 180-degree rotation around some axis. So anything mirror symmetry does, it will tell us about parity symmetry because we have all, we know everything about the rotations. Okay. So then, of course, the question is, how does parity as an operator, parity operator, acting on Poisson? Huh? Right? That's all what we're always interested in. If there is a rotation matrix acting on the spinner, we know what happens. But what if I will act with a parity on the Dirac spinner? What do I expect? Well, that's where well spinner comes in. We have no idea what's Dirac spinner parity acts on Dirac spinner. But there is a chance we can figure out how well spinner behaves. We'll just break this thing in two parts and figure it out. So let's look at the well spinner, which is simpler. And also, on Tuesday, I hope everybody got to the question to realize your right-handed fist is a pretty good right-handed well spin. Yeah? We agree with this? You can use your fingers to count for the spin, angular momentum, and this is your moment. So this is the time that you can do it yourself to figure out what should we expect. So what I propose to do is that I hope most of you guys have some electronic device, such as a phone. And if you turn it onto the selfie mode, it's a pretty good mirror. Okay? I think globally, there must be enough mirrors in this classroom to make it happen, is that we should have enough self-taking camera thing. Maybe in your computer, there is an app. And work in group, make as much noise as possible, talk to each other. And what I want you to do is that here is a mirror. Let's agree on some conventions. We all hold a mirror like this. So don't do that. Otherwise, we might not agree on something. I just want to pick some XYZ axis. Hold a mirror like this, and I claim you can come up with three different well spinners. Three different right-handed well spinner if you're right-handed. Three different left-handed well spinner if you're left-handed. But there are three different ones. One of them will be going up and down. One of them will be going left and right. And one of them going into the page, other page. I'm just talking where my thumb is going. So there are three different kind well spin. And I want you to examine what happens to their momentum, which is where the thumb is pointing, and what happened to their angular momentum, which is described by your fingers. So here you go. And I'll be drawing things on the board because I draw really slowly. I'm really bad at drawing this. So you have quite a long time to figure this out. So that one, and that one, and that one. So let's label them. There's one looks like this. I'll draw the other parts later. And one of them looks like this. And then one of them looks like this. Okay, discuss with each other, find a mirror, looking at them, just put your hand in front of the mirror and see what happens in the mirror. And while you all discuss, I will work on my drawing. So we have two volunteers demonstrating mirror. And what happens to a well spinner. You just do whatever you just did again.
This is for 500.
Thank you very much. And I think they use a very clever way to answer the question I'm trying to ask. It's a very clever way. And we'll come back to their demonstration in a couple minutes. So I'm trying to draw some well spinners. And I hope you guys notice the same thing as me, is that in the first case, does the momentum change if your momentum is pointing up? No. But then what about your spin?
Yes.
Okay. Spin change. Momentum stay. And then, what about in the case of you are pointing into the mirror? Does your momentum change?
Yes.
Yes. What about the spin? What about in this case, if you're going into the page, into the board? The momentum stays. And what about the spin?
Flips.
Spin flips. Flips is a better word, you know. The moral of the story is something is going to change and the other thing is not going to change. And now, recall our helicity formula. Helicity is a projection of angular momentum onto momentum. So if you change one of them, but not both of them, that tells us all this saying the same thing is that the helicity flips. Because it's a projection. I'm projecting one thing to the other, but the other flipped. Of course, your projection changed. And then, so hence we conclude, if I start out with a right-handed well spinner, I'm going to get a left-handed well spinner, as demonstrated by our two volunteers. If you have been watching the demonstration, that at the very beginning, when they are using only one hand, they are using different hands to demonstrate the mirror. When you look into the mirror, the mirror actually change your right hand to the left hand. So that's why it's quite important to relate our well spinner to the handiness of the well spinner to our hands. Then we can make this conclusion much faster. Okay, so now we realize what parity does to well spinner. It flips them. So now let's recall, okay, I'm going to go into well basis just because it's so much easier. So I have W plus, W minus. And in the parity, as we just see, what it does is it flips them.
Shouldn't that be mirror symmetry?
Yeah, but remember mirror symmetry and the parity is related by 180 rotation, which 180 rotation does some. So yeah, you can say that. So what we showed is mirror symmetry. But mirror symmetry is different to parity by 180 rotation, which that's something you can independently figure out. Yeah.
I'm confused because so I thought ball spinners had to do with chirality, not with helicity.
But remember, at some point we show that they are the same, like for massless.
For massless.
Yeah, we're still talking about massless.
Okay, massless.
Sorry. Like, yeah, there is a difference between our hand and the well spinner. Is our hand has mass, but the well spinner doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah, we are talking. Well, so basically, from on Tuesday onward, whenever we mention the well spinner, it can't have mass. That's what we showed here. They're not exists a term look like this. Just doesn't exist. Okay, so we figured out this parity. Let me use parity because this is what everybody else uses. Yeah.
Stupid question. So like after doing the mirror symmetry,
yeah,
figure out that left-handed becomes right-handed.
Right. Uh-huh.
Depending on where we define the z-axis, will in general always doing this 180 rotation lead to no change?
Yep. Whichever direction your mirror is, It's always related to parity by 180 degree rotation. You just have to choose your axis always to be perpendicular to your mirror. So it's always equals to a mirror symmetry and a rotation around the mirror. That's why we talk about parity. Otherwise, you always have to specify, my mirror is in this direction. That'd be silly. So parity, independent of your choice of axis, it flips all your axes anyway. So this, you can actually guess what does parity do to a Dirac spinner. Which of our gamma matrix does exactly that? If I want to write a matrix multiplication, it seems if I put identity here, that's exactly what it does. Flipped, right? So we have this conclusion. And then, of course, there's some plus minus ambiguity in there. You probably can put some sort of coefficient and it still works. Because when we get this, we don't know if it has a minus sign. Who knows, like, if there's, what we know is that the helicity of the Weyl spinner we get from mirror symmetry is, the helicity is different, but different by, but like the Weyl spinner itself might have a coefficient. So there could be a coefficient there. And you can, there's a tutorial online if you're interested to inspect which sign it is for each particle. But we're gonna ignore that to make our life simpler and then decide that's what it is. A parity operator acting on Dirac operator is just like gamma zero acting. So let me write this up. What do I mean by parity operator acting on Poisson? I really mean that I change the dependence of the spinner. Yeah? That's exactly what parity means. I found whatever the parity is x on, I change all the spatial components, leave time alone. And then what we claim is that this is true. And now we can do our little thing. Classification thing. Remember, I said we're going to take a very thorough approach to solve the problem of writing down an interaction term for weak interaction by writing down all possible interactions. That's actually possible if you put something like not, it needs to be renormalizable condition, then you are able to write down all possible interactions. You just have to pick the correct one. So let me try. So far, we haven't seen this guy, which is the master. Yeah.
In the Dirac Lagrangian, the sine bar, that's like
yeah.
I dagger times gamma zero.
Yeah.
And so does that particular term have any relationship with the?
Yeah. We will immediately see. That will come up in 3 minutes, plus minus 1 minute. Okay. Very good question. Very good question. But I'm going to follow my task. I'm very ambitious, and I want to write down every possible term ever exist in fermionic interaction theory. Well, these things are called fermion bilinears. So it has a Poisson bar, has a Poisson, and there are some random things in the middle. Okay, so we have seen this. That's the mass term. And the next one is the kinetic term. Yeah? So I can just keep going. Who can stop me? I'll just keep going along the same idea. Yeah, somebody should say something. You're welcome to yell at me.
Can you have more than four notes?
Very good, thank you. She noticed a very, very important problem. If I have more than four of them, but I only have four gamma matrices, and if I have more than four of them, I can always just swap, and then two of them together, they become one or minus. That's a very good point. I was being very silly. That's why I said we are able to write down all the possible interaction terms precisely because of that. There's no more gamma matrix available anymore. Okay, so the next step we do is to realize, for example, this term. No matter what I pick for these four things, it's basically always 0, 1, 2, 3. I only have four, I use them each once, because as soon as I use something the same, it's no longer have four gamma matrices. So you can check that. But wait, did I just say that I can use 0, 1, 2, 3 only once each? What is it? What matrix is using gamma 0, 1, 2, 3?
Gamma 5.
Gamma 5. So you can show, actually, there's only one independent component out of this, which is precisely psi bar gamma 5 psi. All the others are not in this category. You can choose both this to be zero, then it becomes something else. The only independent one would be this. And by the same argument, actually you can trade three gamma matrices to be a gamma five. But you were like, but gamma five into five needs four of them. No problem, I'll give you one. The gamma 5 has four of them. Well, no matter which gamma matrix this guy is, it's going to cancel one of them in the gamma 5. There'll be three left. So this is precisely this. And for this, actually, this is precisely if you put the Lorentz generator, because the anti-commutator is just a lemma. Then you go back to there. Only the commutator survives. And those two are simple enough that there's nothing to simplify. Yeah?
You mentioned that this is like the list of all possible interactions.
Mm-hmm.
Stupid question, can't there be like three psi's? That's all.
Well, if you have, you need a two psi bar psi to cancel your spinner index. You definitely can't have a third.
Right.
You could have four. That's actually very famous. It's Fermi's four fermion interaction. But if you consider this thing called the renormalizable series, the claim is all the ones that has more than one pair of psi are considered to be effective theories. You can always go to higher energy and find a more fundamental theory. But yes, you definitely can't have three. You can have two, and you can have four. Actually, if you look at the four Fermi theory, it's really just one of these multiplied by another of this. So this is still the most fundamental building block if you want to write down a theory of fermions. Okay, so now there's like the book counting. There's one here, there's just one. And this one, there's four here. And we counted, there were six Lorentz generators. There's another four over here. There's one. I'm just counting how many different components there be if I can run mu and nu between 0 and 3. And you tally this up, you said, oh, it's 16. 16 is good. We have 16 independent, if you take care of the components of the spinner components of the Dirac spinner, we have four. So if you pick the different index, there are 16. There's four from here, four from here, and this is just a different way to organize. Okay, this is all very great. And And we're coming back to your question about this gamma zero and the gamma zero in the Dirac conjugate. It's a very good question. That realization makes a lot of our life easier. So what we argued is that psi turns into gamma zero psi in under parity. And then now we argue, of course, psi dagger under parity will turn into psi dagger gamma zero. I'm just going to dagger that. And now I look at this Dirac conjugate and I realize Dirac conjugate turn into psi dagger gamma zero, but then there's another gamma zero, so it becomes psi dagger. So that's where the parity gamma zero and the Dirac conjugate that gamma zero cancel, and this would work. So now we can look at all these things.
In the third step, that's psi dagger.
Huh?
Third line is that psi dagger.
Yeah. So the conjugate, the Dirac conjugate is multiply another gamma zero here, and it becomes psi dagger. That's the idea. This is not a typo. That's exactly what I meant. A psi bar will turn into a psi dagger. Okay, so now we can just go through the list and let's see what happens if I put the psi bar psi through this parity. You get a psi dagger from the psi bar, but you get a gamma zero psi from the psi, and this gives you back psi bar psi. That tells us the mass term does not violate parity. It's the same. And you can also check the next one, which is the second in the list. And then you put it under the parity. Now you have to be careful. When mu equals zero, it gets psi dagger gamma zero. Psi dagger is what psi bar turn into gamma zero is the zeroth component of this guy, and then you have gamma zero psi from there. And this can be written as psi bar gamma zero psi. But for the other components, you have psi dagger, which is how psi bar transform. Then you see this guy, which is gamma I, and you have gamma zero psi, and it turns into, well, it turns into, I have to swap things first. And it turns into the negative of itself. So if you start with psi bar, gamma mu psi, which behave like a vector, then it indeed, under parity, it also behave like a vector, which is the time component is the same, but the spatial component pick up a minus I. Remember, that's what we define to be parity, is you have Tx, T stay the same, X flipped. So that's why we call this vector. And the QED is a vector interaction. That's why that if you do anything with your electromagnetism, you design any sort of experiment, and then you design the experiment in the mirror, you will find no difference. You will not be able to tell if you live in the mirror universe or live in your own universe if you only do E and M experiments. Very small letters as in the future, you will discover QCD also enjoys vector interaction. That's why you kind of do strong force experiment to discover you're in the mirror or not. Okay. We'll put that one aside. And we'll do the last one first. Because the last one is easy. You have parity, and that's what the Poisson bar do, is turn into Poisson dagger. And the gamma 5 states, Poisson turns into gamma 0 Poisson. Again, you need to swap them so that the gamma 0 is together with Poisson dagger to give us the Dirac conjugate. You realize, huh, this thing pick up a not minus sign. That's what the gamma 5s do, it seems. So this is called a pseudo-scalar. If you look at its Lorentz index, it doesn't have a spinner index. All the spinner index are contracted. There's no index left. This thing has no index. So that's why we call it a scalar. But now he has a new name called pseudo-scalar. It's because after investigation, no, it's not always not a change after Lorentz. If you do this parity discrete symmetry on it, it picks up a minus sign. Okay. Then there is the last one. It's that has gamma 5, gamma mu, psi. And I will invite you to do a small exercise, but I will speculate the answer. Since gamma 5, since it anti-commuter with everything, it seems sticking a gamma 5 into this discussion will flip the sign. So this time, when gamma mu equals 0, it pick up a minus sign. When mu is I, it stays the same. So it behaves like a vector by the fact that it carries this mu index, but not quite, because under parity, it picks up some minus signs. And this is called the axial vector. And now we come to our conclusion. We certainly can't pick the interaction term that does not change. If it doesn't change under parity, the vector stays as a vector. If the scalar stays as a scalar, that's not going to help us with weak interaction. But there is this one candidate. It's perfectly reasonable to find a vector field to couple onto it, and that will be the weak interaction. So this is for weak. This axial vector interaction is for weak interaction, and it is picked because the parity is violated. Yep.
What about the S mu nu?
Yeah, so the S mu nu, I looked into it. You need something have two index to couple to it. So what the people normally write down is to couple to F mu, the strength tensor of the ENM. It turns out that there are a lot of people studying on this. And I can try to give you a reference later. But to this term, normally we don't talk about it because it is non-renormalizable. Also, it's not observed so far. Like lots of people try to observe it. Like people say, let's assume that term exists. What kind of observable effect on some particle? And they're looking for some magnetic moment or electric type moment of some particle. And they are looking for it. And at this point, the coefficient is determined to be very close to zero. Actually, it's whatever we observe is not deviated by. It has no deviation from that term multiplier zero. But now we end our story. We start with looking at the experiment and wonder that how can we find such thing that can vary violate a parity to explain the experiment, and we found it. And actually, if you look at this, if you are taking standard model, you would see that all the weak interactions is preferably written in well spinner directly, just because only one kind of well spinner participate in weak interaction. The other one doesn't. So if you see weak interaction, you would always either see some gamma fives around, actually you will see the projection operator around. So what really look in, if you look in at the standard model like Lagrangian, you would see not a gamma five, but the projection operator. And then, let me make the comment.
Where is my comment?
Yeah, that's the comment. So there is mass term is interaction term. Now let me come back to that. Is basically what happens in standard model is that they found two wall spinner. They were willing to, so what exactly happened there is they have, let me label them as one and a two, just means they are two completely different well spinner. And what's the problem is that only the left-handed spinner participated in weak interaction. So if you write down such a term, it's actually not a gauge invariant. So what a famous person called Hicks does is that he conjectures a scalar that transforms in a weak interaction in some way such that the whole thing is gauge invariant. And then he needed this thing to disappear. He proposed that the Higgs has a potential that the minimum is not at a zero, but at here. So that's all the later story, how is this eventually turned into the standard model Lagrangian. Or the other way, how the standard model Lagrangian Higgs mechanism to produce fermion mass eventually gave us this. But that's completely out of scope. But I feel that's a complete story now. So in history, of course, the things happened in the other order. So there are two American-Chinese physicists decided to investigate the possibility of the parity not being conserved. And then they write down something. Then they talk to C.S. Wu, says, can you do this experiment? And actually did it during a Christmas, actually. The most ironic thing is that almost immediately, this is how important this experiment is, almost immediately after her experiment is repeated by other physicists and found the same result, there is a Nobel Prize given to the two theorists, but not. It's just a history. I think normally the physics Nobel Prize is given to both theorists and experimentalists. And this is a very rare exception. Of course, she is very like revered by lots of physicists. And she's really good. I hope she's good. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about, just because we are on the same note as symmetry, I would like to mention the continuous symmetry too. And I hope that after David and Dan, you would know the Neusser procedure very well by now. The Neusser, the one that Dan proposed, is that you consider psi is changed infinitesimally by some y thingy, And then I'll take the really easy case. I'll say, I'll take the case, special case that the Lagrangian doesn't change. Then you can immediately write down your current as partial L partial U times certified. Yeah, this should look familiar with you. You have seen it multiple times, and I eliminate some other term is not interesting to me. Okay. Why? So let's figure out what's precise. Here is my Lagrangian, and I only cares about the connector term because I'm doing the derivative with respect to the connector. And the thing left is I cosine bar partial mu this third. I left it with gamma mu. And then some y in these. Right? I just need to figure out what's y. So I'm actually going to use the same exactly same thing, which is this thing. Yeah? So then delta psi, this is the exponential expansion. And then I'll stick there. And the I and the minus I cancels, and I'm arrived at this thing. Yeah, this is a calculation that it's very important. How if there is a phase change global symmetry, what kind of a Nernst current can you get? Yeah, and now we'll just take a look at it. The zeros component, which is also a very common thing for us to do, and using the definition of Dirac conjugate, we find that the zeros component of the current looks like a Psi dagger Psi, and I can define some conserved quantity by integrated over the space. And now we finally come back to conclude with our journey with Dirac from Monday. Remember Monday that the Dirac is really unhappy because the density can't be called a probability density because it's not a positive definite. So of course Dirac write down his equation and look for this density. It's something dagger psi. So this make Dirac very happy. And of course you have learned in the scalar theory that we can't really, Dirac equation has way more potential to be even greater equation than it is. That interpreting this as a wave function will limit it into relative quantum mechanics. And if you study the field theory, which is necessary because then you can study when the in the process of such like one particle decay into two. Such process cannot be studied in quantum mechanics because they assume the probability is all like the number. The number of particles do not change. So, no, I think I'll stop here. And,
And tomorrow, we'll quantize the Dirac field.